Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the rebooted version of Carl Sagan's TV series from 1980, Cosmos, premiered last night in under an hour. It handily explained the place of our tiny Earth in the universe, which, as the star of the show says, is just one universe in an infinite ocean of universes. My next guest is the star and host of the new Cosmos show. Yes, he's an astrophysicist, and not just any astrophysicist. He's the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History and the author of the book, The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. He's probably America's favorite astrophysicist. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, yes, it is time for Ask an Astrophysicist. So anything you want to ask Neil deGrasse Tyson about galaxies near or far, you can give us a call right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I'll start. What do you mean when you say the universe we know is just one in an infinite ocean of universes? I thought universe usually referred to the one big ball of everything while we have tons and tons of galaxies. Am I taking this too literally?
Well, so first, I didn't say that we are one of a multiverse. It's that we may be one of a multiverse. There's good theoretical motivation to think that our universe is but one bubble of some uncountable multitude of other bubbles of universes, each bearing slightly differently expressed laws of physics, which would make it particularly dangerous to visit one of these because our body is held together by certain fundamental forces that if you visit a universe where those laws are slightly different, there is no telling what would happen to your human physiology.
But by definition, could we, because of the universe that we're in, with the laws of physics that we live within, not ever be able to prove the existence of another universe?
Well, we don't know that. So you want to explore. This is a typical dilemma that you confront when you have a cool idea and it somehow at first pass feels sort of intractable experimentally. However, it may be that – I'm just making this up, but it's an example. If there could be a universe that is nearby in this hyperdimensional space, and there could be some forces expressed within that universe that leak out of that universe that we then feel. There's an idea, for example, that dark matter, what we call dark matter, is not really matter at all or any kind of exotic matter, but it could be an adjacent universe whose ordinary gravity we feel that has permeated the membranes of the two universes. And here we are touching the side of the elephant, wondering what we're looking at, making up stuff when it's really just ordinary matter in an adjacent universe.
And did you say just a minute ago that there is some evidence that would be tantalizing to scientists that something like that is possible? Is there actually evidence that you can point
to? No, there's no evidence. There are theoretically compelling arguments for why it would exist, and it comes from the marriage of quantum physics, which is the science of the small, with general relativity, which is the science of the large. And the early universe, the large was small, and so you have quantum phenomena influencing what would otherwise have been a macroscopic presence of the universe. And so in quantum physics, you have fluctuations in the vacuum of space. And if the whole universe is small, one of your fluctuations could then be an entire universe.
So maybe a little closer to home is...
I think everyone should have their mind blown at least once a day.
Absolutely. So, and yeah. We just had it. And we may... Who knows how many times in the next 15 minutes this will happen
again.
That's
all you have? You gave me 15 minutes to tell you about the universe?
Stay longer if you want. I thought that's all the time you had. Bob on Staten Island, you're on WNYC with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hi.
Hi. This is my question. If you ever see an explosion, like a fireworks, everything, apply it to the Big Bang, everything goes away from each other. It doesn't go towards. So why are we going to merge with the Andromeda Galaxy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it turns out there in the formation of the universe, if you were if you had a proximity to something that was, you know, relatively nearby, you could become gravitationally bound to it. And when you're gravitationally bound, the expansion of the universe doesn't overcome that. So we and the Andromeda Galaxy are together. We've been together from the beginning, slowly drifting towards one another. As you get farther away from one another in the universe, it's much harder. In fact, it would be impossible to be gravitationally bound given how much mass you have, and then this expansion of the universe overtakes it. So all of the colliding galaxies and merging galaxies, those were all very near one another from the beginning, and they were a lost cause from the start. And if you want to think of that as a lost cause, but anything of any sizable distance, they are moving away no matter what.
Terry at JFK Airport. You're on WNYC. Hello.
So someone does live at the airport.
Great show yesterday.
Oh, thank you.
My question
lives at the airport waiting for the delayed flight.
Yeah, okay.
Terry, go ahead. Sorry.
If we can get particles, protons moving 99.99999, the speed of light in a Large Hadron Collider, what would it take for it to get it to actually move the speed of light?
Yeah, so all of our theoretical understanding of motion and relativity offered to us by Einstein and verified by experiment, that if you take a material object and try to accelerate it, it takes more and more energy to get that incremental extra speed out of it. And so this 99.9999% of the speed of light, we're getting that with really tiny particles where you can put a sizable amount of energy in them and get them that close. But to do that with a human or a car or a spaceship, the level of energy to do that there's nothing we have access to. Now, I know it's fun to be able to say you went the speed of light, but in terms of actually going places, 99% of the speed of light ought to be just fine compared with 99.99999. You're not going to get there that much later. So other than the interest that the physical problem might have, how would you ever travel the speed of light? In terms of practical transportation, there's no real need to have to do that.
Terry, thank you. And so to take our last two calls, the answers to which blew our minds two more times,
okay.
Are there any practical implications, for example, with the merging with the other galaxy? Does that mean we're going to collide with a whole other, you know, collection of planets and suns and stuff?
You're still disturbed about the collision.
Collisions can be very traumatic.
Well, so there's this galaxy Andromeda, which has, you know, several hundred billion stars, and we live in the Milky Way, several hundred billion stars. We're going to collide, and it's going to be a train wreck. We've seen it in the rest of the universe. You can't wait around to watch it happen because the collision takes several hundred million years. But we have photographic evidence of galaxies in all stages of collision, which was a fascinating revelation coming out of the 1960s and 70s. We had catalogs of galaxies, and those that were in collision were simply described as disturbed or irregular, without really us yet understanding that they're two normal galaxies, full red-blooded galaxies, getting destroyed in an impact. And there's a famous astrophysicist of the day, Gerard Vaucouleurs, who noted that a crashed Lexus is still a Lexus. It just happens to be crashed. So in that state of mind and that understanding, we know what this is going to look like as we go forward.
So by furthering that analogy, the person in the crashed Lexus is probably dead.
Well, okay, so it turns out galaxies, the separation between stars within a galaxy is so vast relative to the size of the star, that the stars within the galaxies will just pass by one another like ships in the night. But what will not pass by one another are the huge gas clouds that are manufacturing stars. The gas clouds are space-filling, and when they hit one another, they will collide and stick like two hot marshmallows. And in the collision zone, you can trigger huge bursts of star formation. And so it'll be a spectacle to watch in the night.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson from the Museum of Natural History, the Hayden Planetarium, and the host of the new Cosmos TV series, which premiered last night. And, oh, we have a follow-up. This is probably the show's first ever follow-up question on a statement about the multiverse.
Okay.
But it's Larry in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello. Larry, you there?
Yes, I am. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
My question is that in the multiverse and the initial Big Bang prior to that, you have inherently the 11 dimensions of space entrapped in the prior to the Big Bang. And so, you know, in quantum mechanics, you have Bell's theorem of entanglement. And I was wondering if Degrassi could speak to the fact that it's a possibility that you have all space connected everywhere from the original Big Bang.
Yeah, so entanglement is a fascinating phenomenon in quantum physics where you can have two particles where their state. In quantum mechanics, you speak of not where a particle is specifically, but what properties it has in the state that it's in. And the particle is not only a physical particle, but it's also a wave, and the two waves can become commingled. And we think of that as entanglement. When the moment you become macroscopic, expanding beyond the size of the atom, the entanglement no longer applies. It just doesn't. And the quantum physics, in fact, it's why quantum physics is so foreign to our sensibilities, because there's nothing in our life experience that takes us there. The moment we become macroscopic, then classical, what we call classical laws of physics, become a much more accurate description of what's going on. So it'd be fun to think of entanglement in the early universe, but right now, no, there's no, we're done with that.
Larry, thank you for your call. So the first episode of Cosmos told the story, among other things, of a 16th century Italian monk, Giordano Bruno, who publicly thought that said that he thought the universe was infinite, and he was dismissed and then eventually excommunicated and killed by the Catholic Church. Did you bring that into the show because you see any scary parallels to the scuffles between science and religion today?
Well, so first, the show is written by Andrian and Steve Soder, a colleague of mine up at the museum, and they actually wrote the first two space shows of the newly rebuilt Hayden Planetarium as part of the Rose Center for Earth and Space.
And I hear, by the way, that the current show is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, thank you. We're all very proud of that show. It's Dark Universe. It's called. And it's a celebration, actually, of our ignorance, of not knowing what dark matter or dark energy is. And the great challenge was how to represent that on the dome. How do you portray something that about which you know very little or next to nothing? So, but we can get back to that. But where was I a second ago?
The story of Giordano Bruno.
Yeah, Giordano Bruno. So he was a monk who studied Copernicus, liked the idea that maybe Earth was not in the center of things, that we orbited the sun. And then he took this leap without evidence. He just took a leap and said, if Earth is a planet like the others and the sun is a star like the other stars of the night sky, then maybe the stars of the night sky have planets. And if they have planets, maybe they have Earths. If they have Earths, maybe they have life and people and institutions. And so his God, as he conceived it, was bigger than the God expressed in literally in Scripture or as interpreted by the cardinals of the church of the day. So the issue there is not religion versus non-religion or religion versus science. The issue there is ideas that are different versus dogma. And that can manifest in many ways. You can have political dogma or cultural dogma, social dogma. So because Giordano Bruno was himself religious the whole time. Hmm. He just imagined a bigger God, a God of an infinite universe rather than of one that just focused on Earth.
You see them as compatible today?
See what is compatible?
Religion and anti-dogma views of the universe?
So what you have there are about a third of Western American scientists would claim that there is a God to whom they can pray and have the power of that God intercede with their lives, and the fully functioning, productive scientist who could pass psychological tests for sanity. So empirically, since you have such people who do science and who are also religious, one can say just based on that that they can be compatible. More specifically, however, if you start using your scripture, your religious text, as a source of your science, that's where you run into problems. Yeah. And there is no example of someone reading their scripture and saying, I have a prediction about the world that no one knows yet because this gave me insight. Let's go test this prediction and have that prediction turn out to be correct.
In theory, if there is a God, an intelligence that's the source of the universe or multiverses, as the case may be, that entity could have snapped its fingers and created all the laws of physics, not just, you know, put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden in the traditional way that people think of
it. Well, that's fine, but if you want to now say that all happened in 6 days, that's not consistent with the data. If you want to say that that Earth was created before the sun, which is how Genesis accounts for it, because Earth was dark and you needed – so none of that is consistent with any scientifically derived information about the world. So enlightened religious people know this, and they don't try to use the Bible as a textbook, using a Western example. So the problems come about when this a minority of the religious community who want to say that the Bible is literally true, where they want to go in and change the science curriculum. Then you have issues. There's no tradition of scientists or even atheists knocking down the Sunday school door, telling the preacher what to teach. That's never happened, and it never will happen.
Don in Marlboro. You're on WNYC with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hi, Don.
Hi, Dr. Tyson. Hello. Quick question. In your work, Doctor, do you see evidence that creation is still in progress? And I mean as postulated by Teilhard de Chardin, the scientist and Jesuit. Quickly, his views was that evolution proceeds from galaxies to solar systems to planets and then to cells of the organic. And now humanity is in the leading edge. And that edges into a transformation into a new state of existence beyond the current life, which speaks for a God-centered movement of the entire universe.
And you want to get his reaction to that. Okay, well, did you ever hear that theory before?
No, I've not heard of the fellow, but I can tell you that the way you've posed that question, again, forgive me for not having read the text from which you're deriving it, that it presumes that humans are some pinnacle of the expression of evolution. And I remind you that to detect drugs and bombs, we use dogs for that because we can't sniff it out. There are a lot of things that other animals in the animal kingdom can do that we can't. So for us to think of ourselves as some pinnacle of anything requires a profound level of hubris to assert it. And
in fact, if I could jump in, when astronaut Chris Hadfield was on last year, he said...
Good guy, by the way. Yeah.
Great guy. And, you know, fabulous communicator about science, by the way. But he said almost every astronaut, based on their knowledge and experience, believes there must be intelligent life on other planets. Do you agree with that?
Well, you wouldn't have to be an astronaut to have that understanding. You just have to study the problem, and astronauts tend to be well-educated. So it's really the statement of an educated person more than it is the statement of an astronaut. You look out into the universe, and you see how old the universe is. You look at the ingredients that make up life as we know it, and those ingredients are everywhere. And now we know they're rising through thousands of planets in orbit around other stars. So the prospect of life in the universe, especially since on Earth, life formed pretty much as quickly as it possibly could have back after Earth cooled from its formation. And so you say, why would we preclude the possibility of life elsewhere? So now you need enough places with life so that at least one of them would have what we would call intelligent, because most life is not what we would call intelligent. So therefore, most planets, by extrapolation, could have life but not what we think of as intelligent life.
But part of his argument was there are enough planets in the many galaxies that we can surmise have relatively similar atmospheric conditions to Earth. And if we believe that once there's a planet with atmospheric conditions like ours, that it's likely that life somewhat like ours would emerge, then it becomes almost certain. Do you buy it?
No, it's certain for life, for sure. But intelligent life, as we've come to define it, is a little more...
That's more of a stretch.
It's more contingent because, for example, if the asteroid didn't – by the way, I still want to get back to the guy's point about the next state of evolution.
Uh-huh.
But if an asteroid – the asteroid that took out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, had that not struck, there's no way we'd be here having this conversation because the dinosaurs had been around for hundreds of millions of years before that asteroid. They were around for a longer period of time before the asteroid than the time that has elapsed since the asteroid. So we have no reason to suspect that they wouldn't still be here, and they could be Brian Laird dinosaur having this conversation, looking very different from you. Or maybe they wouldn't achieve what we would call intelligence. Intelligence is not an inevitable byproduct of evolution. if we're the only example of intelligence in the history of life on Earth.
So you wanted to get back to that point about evolution?
Oh, yeah. So, first, I don't see us as some pinnacle of form. That was a common way to think of the tree of life for so long because we came up with the tree of life. So you wouldn't come up with the tree of life and say, yep, we're at the bottom. The worms are at the top. We just wouldn't do that.
People don't usually do that.
Right. Or put elephants at the top because their brains are much larger than ours. We just didn't construct it that way. So to imagine that we are still evolving, the only way you evolve, you don't just evolve because you think there's a next space you could occupy in your brain or in your body. You evolve because there is a selection force operating on you that enables people with some property to propagate while others go away. So you would need some community of truly enlightened people who are enlightened in some way that you're describing to be the only ones who survive something, and no one else can have babies, and they have a lot of babies. And then you have put an evolutionary force, a natural selection force on your organism. And then you can think about evolving. But as long as everyone is having babies with each other and we have airplanes that connect any two people in the world, the pace of evolution of the human species by natural forces is something that is practically ground to a halt.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, we're already over our scheduled time, but at the risk of testing your goodwill and that of Sotirios Johnson, who's waiting to do the news, we're going to take one more call for you.
Okay.
And I think it's about the Carl Sagan reference on last night's show from Christian in Brooklyn. Christian, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Tyson, I was a big fan. On the internet a while ago, I saw a response from Dr. Sagan to you inviting you to join him for research. I was wondering if you could talk about your personal connection to Dr. Sagan and if that letter led you to your current state of professional choice, and if you could talk a little bit about that connection. Thank you.
Okay, sure. So you must have missed the show last night because there was a whole section of it where I detailed this, but that's okay. It meant you were probably reading a book.
You spent a day with him. He inscribed a book to you.
Yeah, I was 17 in high school at the Bronx High School of Science. I had applied to colleges, and one of them was Cornell. I had already known since age 9 from a first visit to the Hayden Planetarium that I wanted to study the universe, so my interests were already established. But unknown to me, the admissions officer at Cornell forwarded my application to him at his office to get his reaction. And his reaction was he sent me a personal letter inviting me. And who was I? I was just a kid from the Bronx. And he was already famous. He had been on The Tonight Show and had best-selling books. So that was an extraordinary act of generosity. And I would take him up on that invitation, visit him at Cornell. He showed me the lab, signed a book to me, and one of his books, and drove me back to the bus station. It began to snow. He was concerned I wouldn't get back, wrote his home phone number on a shard of paper, and said, if the bus doesn't get through, call me, spend the night with my family. That's my sort of baptism, if you will, in the universe of Carl. And so I swore if I were ever remotely as famous as he was, that I would have the time, I would carve the time for students in the way he had with me. And so and when I saw Cosmos, I was already in graduate school, the original Cosmos, I realized that one way to communicate was what he was doing, was we had a very fireside manner to him, not I'm professor and you're not. Mm-hmm. And if I would ever was in a position to communicate on that scale, that's what I would do. So that's the whole story right there.
And you are doing it in spades. By the way, I was at the Bronx High School of Science recently and in the science wing, and there was a cartoon.
The whole school is a science wing.
Yeah, that's true. And there was a cartoon posted on the wall that said, when I was your age, Pluto is a planet.
Yeah, and get over it. Yeah.
So Neil,
there's a whole lot was different when I was your age. You know, it was and that's thankfully because it means people are exploring the world and discovering what is new rather than clutching to what is old.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, the host of the new Cosmos series, which premiered last night. 12 more episodes, 12 more Sunday nights. Is that
correct?
Correct.
And it's international, 280 countries, 45 languages. So it should have,
awesome.
We expect it to have quite the impact.
And from the planetarium at the Museum of Natural History and author of The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. An investigative report by Bloomberg News finds a pattern of emergencies by appointment at Mount Sinai Hospital. Specifically, the story says Mount Sinai has made a big push to increase the number of stents it puts in people's arteries, a very profitable procedure. One method of getting paid, suggests the article, doctors advise uninsured patients to show up at the emergency room claiming to have emergency heart symptoms. They then are referred to the cardiology department, which already has an appointment for them to insert a stent. There's a lot more in this article, too, including the possibility that patients who don't need stents at all are being funneled into that risky procedure for the money. Headline, a heart surgery factory with obscene levels of pay, says Bloomberg News. Bloomberg reporter Gary Putka joins me now, one member of the investigative team that reported the story. Hi, Gary. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And your article opens with what you call emergencies by appointment. Tell me, in your words, what you found that deserves that label.
Well, patients would show up at Mount Sinai at in Sunday mornings, and all these patients, that 10 of them that we were able to document, showed up with appointments already at the cath lab, which caused some internal consternation within the hospital about what was going on. Some people complained, and you know, it turned out that the patients did indeed have appointments, and it's caused a great deal of consternation there.
And you cite internal hospital correspondence that cites at least two occasions when patients said they were coached to show up at the ER and claim they were having acute heart symptoms that presumably they were not actually having. Why would a doctor coach a patient to do that?
I can't say in this particular instance why. We couldn't get to the bottom of that. But, you know, we have talked to a number of doctors about this issue in general of sending patients to the ER. And, of course, if you're when it comes to cardiac stents, if you're an emergency, and the most the most common emergency, practically the only emergency that you would go to the emergency room for and wind up getting a stent would be when you were having a heart attack. These patients were stable patients. They were not having heart attacks. So that the reason might be to get paid by insurance. It might be these patients didn't have insurance, or it might be they wouldn't be covered as stable patients to get this procedure through their policy or not. And New York has a very generous New York Medicaid is a very generous emergency fund for paying for Medicaid patients, as we've learned in other instances that have happened in the city recently.
Why won't Medicaid reimburse as well for non-emergency stents if a cardiologist thinks that's indicated? I mean, maybe that's cheap and stupid, and the doctors and hospital are getting around the cheap and stupid insurance rules.
Well, Medicaid will for stable patients under certain circumstances. There's a whole sort of matrix of what makes the stent appropriate. You know, some of the insurers, and I'm not sure exactly what Medicaid does. Medicare and Medicaid, by the way, pay for a lot of stents in stable patients.
So private insurers are in play here.
Private insurers are in play, but also it's just much easier to justify the stent to insurers broadly if there's an emergency, and there's other procedures that would go on in the cath lab that you might not be able to get covered for. If you were not an emergency as well, this would be like an angiogram to see whether you have a stent, to see whether you need a stent, or a number of other procedures that would go on in the cath lab.
So maybe they're gaming the insurance companies.
Yes, maybe.
But to me, the most disturbing part of your article is not the emergency procedures by appointment. It's the part where you hint that patients who may not need stents at all are being funneled to this clinic at Mount Sinai for the money. You write about an arrangement the hospital has with a doctor in Washington Heights. Mount Sinai rents space from Dr. Elisa Guzman of Cardiology Unlimited on West 185th Street. They pay him $24,000 a year rent, you say. And coincidentally, he happens to refer patients to the cardiac catheterization lab at 23 times the average rate of physicians who refer there. Why did you call out this high rate of referrals for stents? What are you implying?
You've done a really good job with describing this. You're stealing all my thunder here. Let me give you a bit of background. Maybe that would be useful. The issue of who does and who doesn't need a stent and whether stents are overused is very, very contentious in cardiology. Plenty of studies show that that medicine is just as good in stable patients for stents, medicine and a little bit of lifestyle adjustment. So this is a very controversial issue, and no fewer than 11 hospitals around the country, with maybe four or five more under investigation, prominent hospitals or doctors at prominent hospitals, have been slapped around by the Justice Department and reached settlements over the kinds of arrangements where doctors were allegedly getting payments to refer patients to the labs. And in many of these cases, the Justice Department has alleged these people did not need the stents. This was purely done for purposes of making money. So New York City, as it happens, is a market that has a much higher usage of stents than the rest of the country. All five boroughs are above average in the number of stents per Medicare patients. All five boroughs are above average in the number of stents given for every scan of a heart. So there's a lot of indication that stents are overused in New York, and there's also a lot of indication that, as you've recounted here with Dr. Guzman, that that people who have who Sinai has sort of recruited for office use are sending tons of patients to Mount Sinai.
Should we assume that if there is one clinic feeding to the business or the busiest stent lab in the city with apparent financial incentives, that others are too? Because your other sources say they're combing the streets in all the boroughs for potential stent patients. I'm trying to connect the dots.
Yeah, well, we found evidence of at least seven doctors or practices that who refer to Sinai in large numbers who also have financial arrangements with Mount Sinai. Now, I should say here, in fairness to the hospital, that they say they don't pay for referrals. They wouldn't go much beyond this to discuss the terms of these arrangements with the doctors. But seven doctors or practices that refer, seven doctors or practices who have financial arrangements with Sinai in 1 year of documents that we saw referred patients at 20 times the rate of the average doctor who refers to Sinai.
And you have this quote from the head of interventional cardiology at SUNY Downstate Hospital in Brooklyn, who says, quote, "You essentially have physicians combing the streets of Staten Island, Queens, Brooklyn, and the Bronx, looking for patients they can screen on a treadmill to feed into the cath lab where the big reimbursement comes," unquote. So is he talking about Mount Sinai in particular or the state of the hospital business generally?
I think there he's talking about the state of the hospital business in New York generally, where when we checked, there are no fewer than 32 hospitals certified to have cath labs that insert stents. I don't think all 32 of those are necessarily practicing. We certainly couldn't find them, but we're told it's a very, very competitive market.
Do the numbers raise a question about whether some of these affiliated cardiology centers, I guess you'd say, or doctors, are sending patients for invasive procedures who don't need them?
I think it raises the question. It can't be said for certain, and we did not, we have not found evidence of that. So let me be clear about that. However, it certainly raises a question. The high stent usage in New York, Mount Sinai is the largest, is the most frequent inserter of stents, does about 5,000 a year of any hospital, not just in the city, but in the country. It claims to be the best and busiest but both the city and the state, and it also claims to be the best and busiest in the country. So,
quote one expert who says that many stents couldn't all be appropriate.
Yes, we do. Sinai would acknowledge that there is a way of measuring whether stents are appropriate or inappropriate. It comes in the form of guidance from the cardiology associations about what's appropriate. So Sinai says its level of inappropriate stent use, as it's called in the guidelines, is among the lowest in the country at about 4%. But there's also a huge number of uncertain stents of uncertain appropriateness, as Sinai itself rates them, that they do.
And you write that the cath lab, that's the cardiac catheterization lab where the stents are inserted, the cath lab extols its volume. and the lab's compensation system for doctors incentivizes more procedures. That's an intriguing sentence. They extol their volume. They boast about how many stents they put in people.
Yes, the cath lab report is full of references to how much the cath lab has grown, how many more procedures they do than their local competition. As you pointed out, there is a system for paying doctors there that rewards more procedures, where if you don't make a certain level of what they call relative value units in the medical trade, which each procedure has a relative value unit associated with it. You necessarily won't make your full salary, or you might have your bonus cut.
So this sounds like the quota system for cops who aren't giving out enough tickets or doing enough stops and frisks in the course of a month. You're telling me that cardiologists working for Mount Sinai Hospital might get their pay reduced if they don't refer enough patients for stents?
So the documents at Mount Sinai that we've seen indicate.
You got quite a story here.
Thank you.
How long did it take you and your colleagues at Bloomberg News to do this investigation?
Some months. We were all doing things in between other stories. It took us a while to gather information on this. This grew out of other stories we've been doing about the state of stenting in the United States over the last year.
How profitable is a stent for the hospital? You refer to it as one of the most profitable things that hospitals do today.
Medicare data show that at Sinai, there's a 42% profit margin for stents. So roughly speaking, the numbers are your insurer is going to wind up paying $20,000 to the hospital. This does not include the doctor's fee. The hospital would get $20,000, and after costs, be left with about $9,000.
What do you hope will come of your article?
We hope to hear from more people about more things that may be going wrong here. To the extent that Sinai, anything is wrong within Sinai, maybe something will be done about it.
We got a very general statement from Mount Sinai Hospital when we informed them that we would be having you on today, just basically defending everything they do as proper and appropriate. Have they been forthcoming with you?
As I indicated before, they've chosen not to discuss the particular terms of the doctors whom they have financial arrangements with. They have not fully addressed the issue of the documents we have that show that patients had previous appointments and came to the emergency. Patients had previous appointments at the cath lab. So I would say they've answered about as generally as they've answered you. Things are proper. They have not gone into a lot of detail with us.
Bloomberg News reporter Gary Putka, part of the investigative team that reported the story about stents and Mount Sinai Hospital. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And, you know, sometimes it takes an outsider to notice what's really going on. My next guest wrote the novel that you may know called Americana, about a woman who comes to America from Nigeria and keenly observes the layers and meaning of race, class, and the fraught politics of middle-class America in so many ways. The author is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Her book, Americana, which is a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Fiction Award, is now out in paperback. Hi, Chimamanda. Such an honor. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And so many contemporary novels are introspective, but your characters are so observant of the culture around them. And for a lot of the book, the structure of American society in many big picture ways, and obviously you are not your characters, but as someone who came to America as an adult, do you think you can see things about this country that people who grew up here can't see?
Yes. but I think that's true for every situation. When my friends who are not Nigerian come to Nigeria, they say things that just make me step back and think, yes, that's actually true. And I hadn't thought about it, because you're so immersed in your own reality that it's easy to to not notice.
Indeed.
Things, yes.
And when your main character, and forgive me, could you pronounce her name?
Ifemelu.
I-F-E-M-U-L-U, Ifemelu. When she comes to the U.S. for college, she's completely baffled by the way race and class are handled here. There's a scene where she's shopping in a store, and the clerk wouldn't identify her colleagues as black and white when she's trying to figure out who helped Ifemelu shop, the black one or the white one. She wouldn't say that. You know the scene I mean?
Yes. That scene was actually, it's very loosely based on an experience that I had, where I had gone shopping with a friend, and there were two helpers in the store. One was black, one was white, and both were dressed in black, both had very long hair. And we were trying to figure out which one had helped us. And so the cashier said, "Was it the one with the long hair?" And I said, "Well, both had long hair." "Was it the one in black?" And I said, "Both were wearing black." And I realized, why can't she just say the obvious, which is, was it the white one or the black one?
Would that be easier in Nigeria?
In Nigeria, race is not a social reality because most of us are black. So race is not an identity marker.
But if there was a white person there, you wouldn't feel
if
so.
If there was a white person, Nigerians would not at all be shy to say that's the white person.
And despite the history of colonialism, of global politics, the way they exist, just because it's an overwhelmingly majority black country.
Well, yes, but also I think it's not so much that the problem is that people are black and white. It's that those identities are weighted with baggage. And so in Nigeria, the idea of being black is not a negative thing. I think in the U.S., the reason people are so uncomfortable with just stating the obvious is that they're worried that, well, if I say the black one, what does it mean? Does it mean I'm saying she's... So then it becomes complicated and wrought.
And the book addresses the differences between American-African and African-American identity. Is it too general a question to ask you how the two groups see each other or how they're treated differently by white America? What's the core of this?
I would say the core is the history that African Americans have slavery in their history, and American Africans don't, because many of them have come from the continent in the past 50 years, while African Americans have been in the U.S. from the very beginning. And I think because those histories are so different, I think both groups experience race differently. And also, I think, are treated by America differently.
Listeners, any readers of Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Americana, or anything else want to call in, 212-433-WNYC, or anyone who just wants to react to the conversation, 212-433-9692, or you can post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll read some of your comments or questions on the air. How about second generation? Kids whose parents are African but who were brought up in America, caught between two groups, or do they get suddenly seen by outside society as, oh, just another African-American kid?
I think everyone who is dark-skinned in America is considered to be the same thing. I think America just lumps everyone into one category of black.
But we have done reporting on employers, for example, who will hire Caribbean immigrants who are black, but not their children, because they perceive the children as African-American, they don't have the accent. And then the two groups, you know, signify, at least yes. to many employers,
yes.
Different kinds of work ethics
yes.
and things like that.
Yes. I mean, I think that's true. I think it's a mistake. I think it's too easy to generalize, you know, and often one is wrong when one generalizes. But
So there's a lot going on. It's complicated. And as the 2008 presidential campaign is going on in the book and things are looking good for Barack Obama, Ifemelu notices Americans of all colors, even, for example, a woman from Haiti who she meets at a dinner party, seem to think racism is basically gone and all is well.
Yes.
There was a moment, I think it was more a media moment than a popular moment, but I guess something was out there. You were here by then, right?
I actually, when Obama was elected, I was in Nigeria. But during the campaign, I was here and I followed it very closely. And I think there was a moment, and I wanted very much to try and capture that sense of a kind of unreasonable optimism and it was exuberant, and and I say it's unreasonable because I think we all just thought Obama was Jesus Christ and he would change water into wine and all would be well, when a basic knowledge of American history would have made it very clear that this would not happen. But so I wanted to try and capture that, just that sense of just, I think, really beautiful, magical hope that so many people shared in. But, you know, the idea of a post-racial America is just absurd.
Martha in Mattawan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Martha.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It was a comment that I had. I'm black. I'm African-American. And it was a comment that I had that was prompted by the discussion, your guest's discussion, of the fact that the salespeople were reluctant to describe people by race. First, the comment was that in reading, what I tend to find when I read constantly, I read widely. In novels, characters are almost never described by race, unless they are not white. White characters, Caucasian characters, are never described. They might talk about bone structure, they might talk about silky hair, or they might talk about the way the aroma or the aura of the person, but they never describe the race unless that person is non-white.
Right, the assumption of the majority as normal.
Absolutely. The other comment that occurred to me also was that your guest is right that there is a reluctance to describe people. There are times when I will describe myself as a short woman with curly hair and light brown skin. And you can almost hear the intake of breath when I talk about my skin color being light brown. I am. That is just me. If my brother had dark brown skin, that's the same as being blonde. No one is reluctant to say she's a blonde, mm-hmm. she's a redhead, she has green eyes. But when I say I'm a brown-skinned woman, I used to be kind of heavy, so I used to call myself a plump, short, brown-skinned woman. You can hear the intake of breath, but there is nothing wrong with that.
Martha, thank you so much.
Thank you. I completely agree with her. I think, and that's one of the questions I think Americana asks about America, which is why? Right? Why? Why? I mean, I think historically, it's really about the valuing of darker-skinned people in this country. And so, you know, like Martha says, why can't we say dark brown, light
brown?
And
I think Americans are confused, black, white, or other, about what's considered acceptable and what's mm-hmm. offensive. You know, the whole affirmative action debate, for example. It's not okay to count by race to discriminate, but it's okay to count by race to include. I don't actually find that such a complicated concept, but a lot of people do.
You know, I don't understand why they would. Because if you're coming from a history where people were excluded primarily because of race, it seems odd to me that somehow the solution to the problem is not supposed to include race. It just seems odd.
Jim in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, your guest is very exciting, and she answered much of my question. When I came from South Asia myself, I saw blacks, when I stopped in Kenya, they're very polite, you know, civilized, as opposed to when you arrive in America, due to slavery, as she mentioned, their behavior is quite the opposite. So my question is this. One-third of African-American men are in jail right now, and the problems seem to get worse with Obama being as president. Would she set up a forum with the generations of Americans born here to transfer the jail population and give them complete amnesty, wipe out the criminal records if they choose to go back to Africa?
Whoa. Well, there's a proposal. I don't know where that's coming from. Wipe out the criminal records if they go back to Africa?
I think that's terrible. I think the premise of that question, I'm sorry, I just completely disagree on so many levels. And I just want to say that I'm not at all suggesting that African Americans are somehow not civilized and well behaved. I have many African American friends who are much better behaved than my Nigerian friends. And, you know, this kind of conversation, I think, worries me because it's about making the victims the problem. You know, the problem is not that African American men have to be sent back to Africa. The problem is that America is a society that structurally has been just really dangerous to be for African Americans. We shouldn't be asking about sending them back to Africa. We should be asking about why, if a black man and a white man commit the same crime, the black man is more likely to get a worse sentence.
And you can't send somebody whose family has been here for generation upon generation back to anywhere else.
Yeah, of course. We could send everyone back to Ireland, back to England, back to Scotland, Germany, Sweden.
My guest is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Her book, Americana, is now out in paperback and a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Fiction Award. We're talking about some of the themes in the book. And how about white perceptions in America of Africa? Pretty much every white person who your main character, Efemlo, meets in the book either thinks she must have grown up starving or eagerly tells her about their charity trip to Africa. Never mind that a lot of the countries people tell her that they've been to or donated to are thousands of miles from Nigeria, but it's the primary media narrative of, you know, Africa in the yes. United States, right?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I experienced much of that. I think many African immigrants do. When you come to the U.S., people just look at you and they immediately feel a kind of pity because you're African. And there isn't a question of the many Africans and the many experiences of Africans. And I wanted to try and play with that a little and sort of poke fun at it as well. Because it's mostly well-meaning, right? People come from a very well-meaning place. But
though from what I've read, you've had a little pushback from people who say your books are not authentically African, whatever that means, because your characters are middle class and college educated. So how do you counter that, what seems to me a ridiculous line of criticism?
Because I'm writing about the Africa I know. And I think that idea of my story not being authentically African comes from ignorance, and that ignorance is based on the single idea of Africa as a place that is poor, starving, has wars, all of those things. And there are many terrible things happening on the continent, but that's not the Africa I know. The Africa I know is the Africa I write about, which is a middle-class Africa of people who are educated, who, you know, that's the Africa I write about. I'm not trying to make a point. I'm trying to write about what I know.
Lola in Weehawken. You're on WNYC. Hello, Lola.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. I was going to say I am actually, I guess you would say, American-African or African-American. I was born in New York, raised in New York till I was 15, moved back to Nigeria to college, medical school, came back to the United States. I've lived here since my mid-20s. This is a very interesting topic. It's an amazing book. I did read it. She's turning out to be one of my favorite authors from Nigeria now. So basically just wanted to say that the experiences she writes about were funny, they were interesting, and there were actually a lot of experiences that we, people who are African, who moved to America, have experienced.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go right on to Rudolph in Queens. Rudolph, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Adichie. Thank you so much for the work you're doing for us, telling our stories. I have a question for you. You recently wrote an essay about gay rights in Nigeria. You were critical of the law that was passed by the government against gays, and you got a lot of negative feedback. Why do you think that Nigerians in Nigeria have a different perception about gay rights compared to Nigerians abroad?
Well, I don't even know that that's necessarily true. I think there are many Nigerians abroad who also are supportive of this law. This law that passed in Nigeria, popularly known as the anti-gay law, it's a law that criminalizes homosexuality. I wrote the piece because I was horrified by it and because I think it's important. I wanted to start a conversation with Nigerians of my generation. I think part of it is religion. Religion has so clouded the discourse on topics of this sort that very often it's no longer about humanity. It just becomes about, you know, the Bible said this is wrong, therefore we should stone them kind of thing. And I know that I got a lot of negative feedback, which, you know, I would write that piece again today if I had to. That's not. But for every, you know, 10 people who said, oh, you know, you're possessed by the demons and that sort of thing, one person has said, I'm rethinking this and I'm starting to see that it makes no sense at all to criminalize people for being who they are.
You okay with that, Rudolph?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Before you go, I do want to point out that Americana is a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle, Books Book Critics Circle Fiction Award, and that ceremony is this evening.
Yes.
At 6 o'clock, and it's actually free and open to the public, so 6 p.m. at the New School. And I guess, Chimamanda, you now have thousands of additional people with a rooting interest in you winning that prize tonight after hearing you here today.
It's just really lovely to be on the shortlist. Winning is not that. I'm in such great company. It's such a lovely thing.
You're awesome to say so. And so last question, how did you feel when you heard Beyonce wanted to sample your TED speech on feminism in a song on her new album?
I really think that anything that gets people, especially young people, talking about gender inequality is a wonderful thing.
So we will leave it there and do a little sampling of that of ourselves. Beyonce, channeling Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, her book Americana. Thank you.
Thank you.
And economic equality of the sexes.
You wake up, post up, run around in it, blossom on it.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.